I'm Christopher Lydon in New Haven, tracking the undercurrents of anxiety in this presidential campaign with Jacob Hacker, a political scientist at Yale. Winner Take All Politics is the baseline book on the nervous condition of America in 2012 that Jacob Hacker wrote with Paul Pearson of Berkeley. I'm asking Jacob Hacker for a short explanation of this almost unnameable unease. Is there a short answer, Jacob Hacker?
I think there is a short answer. It's that we have seen the worst financial crisis since the Great Depression at a time when we've seen runaway inequality and growing polarization of our politics. And that combustible mix is what's come together in 2012 to create this very stark choice between a conservative Republican who is arguing that we should have a much more limited government but big tax cuts for those at the top, and a liberal Democrat, President Barack Obama, who really wants to try to put the focus back on how we address some of the long-term economic problems, namely economic inequality. And we're doing all this in the midst of a terrible economy. So this is the immediate combustible mix that comes together. But if you're asking how we got there, how we got to the Great Recession, how we got to the Great Financial Crisis, my co-author Paul Pearson and I, in our book, Winner Take All Politics, talk about a 30-year war, a 30-year attempt to rewrite the rules of the economic game in a way that helped disproportionately those at the top, made the middle class less secure, and yes, made our politics much, much more divided, much more polarized. It has to do with the mobilization of business in American politics. It has to do with the dominance of money in American politics, which we see writ large in the wake of Citizens United. And it has to do with the transit of one party, the Republican Party, dramatically to the right, being pulled by money, being pulled by its intense ideological activist base, which is symbolized today by the Tea Party. So it's a combustible mix.
How did we come to the culture that can deal with such huge inequality?
Well, we created that inequality. And I say we, I mean our government. One of the most common misperceptions, I think, is that the inequality we see today, which is really about the very, very rich pulling away from the rest of America. We have some startling statistics in the book, but I'll just give you one, that about 1%, the top 1% received over half of all of the growth in income after taxes and benefits in the 2000s. And we've seen in the recent recovery, according to some recent statistics, that almost all of the gains have been at the top. So that economy where the rich have pulled away from the rest has its roots in a lot of changes in government policy and politics that was not just driven by globalization or technological change. Mm-hmm. There was massive tax cuts at the very top, particularly for the top of the top. There was financial deregulation, which fueled the kind of financial excesses that rewarded those at the top, but also created great risks for the rest of us. There were changes in corporate governance, a sort of withdrawal of the federal government from regulation of corporate behavior. All of these things mattered immensely in paving the way for what we call a winner-take-all economy. Mm-hmm. So I don't think it was ever a conscious choice on the part of most Americans, but it clearly was something that resulted from deliberate policies and deliberate attempts to block government responses by some of the most affluent and influential and organized elements of American society over the last generation.
You remind me of Dan Ariely in a conversation we had in a study he did in which vast numbers, much more than the usual polling sample, were given a sort of blindfold choice between the distribution of power and money specifically as it is in Sweden and as it is in this country. 90% of us, when the labels are taken off the distributions, would rather be living in Sweden. Your studies find that 90% of Americans are not doing as well as the average including the incredible spike of the 1%. Why don't we have a 90% movement or even a 40% movement representing that loss?
That's the question that most people ask, and it's the one that we puzzled over as we were writing the book. As we got deeper and deeper into the investigations, we actually came to the conclusion that it isn't entirely the right question, because I think it's wrong to assume that this transformation was somehow a reflection of broad public support for these policies or their outcomes. Rather, as we argue in the book, it really reflected the organized efforts of both corporations and Wall Street, as well as of intense ideological activists, particularly on the right. And that was what drove these changes. That said, I do think that for most Americans, these changes have been viewed very unfavorably. In fact, a lot of the resentment boiling up both on the left and the right is reflective of a kind of distrust of government and of Wall Street alike, feeling that there is kind of a crony capitalist system in the United States. On one side says the way we get rid of that is to, you know, cut government back dramatically. Mm-hmm. The deficit is a sign of special interest influence. And the other side, the much less vocal side, but one that received attention during the Occupy Wall Street protest, says, no, this is about the corruption of our government. This is, and we need to have a more robust response to the strains that middle-class Americans are facing, and government has to play a role in that. My own thinking about this is that if you look at the polls, you find that most Americans, while they have differing and complex views about inequality, have very clear views about the way our American politics has changed. Money in politics, the sense that special interests dominate the process, the feeling that their voices aren't being heard, the sense that the priorities of Washington are not the priorities of sort of Main Street Americans, that is very broadly felt. But when you're disillusioned with your government and your politics, it's hard to feel that the solution, as it is ultimately the solution, has to be a more effective government response.
Hmm. Jacob Hacker, let me say, what I love about your work, and not just this book, is that you have a mind that's eternally at war with the line. The line has been that there's something in economics, in the nature of global economics, that has forced us into this polarization. You say, no, it's the politics. The line has been that this is the child of Ronald Reagan. You say, no, it began with Jimmy Carter, and it accelerated under Bill Clinton before going into space with George W. Bush. There are a lot of points at which you're telling us, no, we've been hoodwinked. We're hoodwinked every day, especially, and starting with the New York Times, all of our big media. What do you take to be the line about 2012, and how would you like to amend it?
I think the biggest problem in 2012 in the discussion is what some people are taking to call the kind of false equivalency premise. And that is that while both parties have moved away from the center, we have to have a centrist party come in. You know, American elect didn't make it, but there's got to be someone out there who can represent this forgotten center, that's going to be all about facing up to the nation's real problem, which is the deficit. And we just need to have, you know, more agreement between the parties, both of which have run to the extremes, to really deal with these problems. And I think that is false, false equivalency premise. And we show in the book that there is no comparison between the two parties in their degree of divergence from the center. That is, the right has moved dramatically, the Republicans have moved dramatically to the right, and Democrats have moved modestly to the left. But also, I think, no comparison in terms of the effect of growing inequality on the parties and the role they've played in it. So for Republicans, money in politics has been sort of enabling development, that this sort of push for corporations into the public sphere and the growing role of campaign money and the degree to which the revolving door in Washington spins faster and faster between working in Congress and lobbying Congress, that those things have all been highly reinforcing of the Republican economic agenda. For Democrats, it's really cross-pressured them. So you see President Obama, for example, quite torn between Wall Street's big contributions on the one hand and his quite sincere, I believe, belief that we need to step up regulation of Wall Street. And so that is part of the reason the two parties, I think, have not polarized evenly, that the Republicans have been drawn dramatically to the right, the Democrats have been pulled modestly away from the center. And you see that in the economic debate. So right now, you know, we're coming off of a debt ceiling fight. We're running toward another debt ceiling fight and a huge fight over expiring tax provisions and change and automatic spending cuts. And as we move toward that, right, we have President Obama, who has previously shown some willingness to make some pretty hard calls for his relative to where his party stands, who sincerely wanted to get a deal. And then we have congressional Republicans and the presidential candidate, now presidential candidate Mitt Romney, who are saying we need to dramatically slash government, cut taxes. We would not even support any deal that has any revenue increases, even, you know, a 10-to-1 ratio. That's what the candidates were asked about during the campaign. So I think, again, it's not an equivalent position, right? It's a very, very asymmetric situation. And in these kind of fights, the more intense side, the side that is more willing to take hostages, more willing to hold out against compromise, often has the upper hand.
Can I be a little skeptical? What is the evidence that President Obama is sincere about re-regulating Wall Street?
Well, the main evidence, I think, is that he was supportive of the Dodd-Frank legislation and worked hard to try to get that passed. And that legislation, while it has many weaknesses and was probably resulted in a lot of private sighs of relief from people on Wall Street because it could have gone much farther, nonetheless was opposed by the key Wall Street lobbyists, and also is now vilified by them and many Republicans as a huge imposition. Mm-hmm. So I think Dodd-Frank is probably not the right framework for regulatory reform, but that's quite different from thinking that that President Obama isn't sincerely seeking to try to create a more stable financial system that is less prone to these kind of abuses that led to the financial crisis.
But surely we're looking at a president with a divided heart, certainly a divided financial base.
Yes, and that's why the Democratic Party has been much more divided. And during the 1990s and 2000s, in the run-up to the 2006 Democratic capture of Congress and 2008 election of President Obama, The party became much more capable of raising money from corporate quarters. As we describe, it was once the case that Republicans had 6-to-1 financial advantages over Democrats. And through Chuck Schumer and his aggressive fundraising on Wall Street, through Rahm Emanuel and his very skillful strategy of cultivating big donors, Tony Coelho, these figures in the Democratic Party figured out how to get money. And there's a great quote we have in the book, which is from Rahm Emanuel, where he's said to have divided campaigns into three parts. In the first part was about money, money, money. The second part, he said, was about money, money, and press. And the third part was about money, press, and votes. So if you're keeping score at home, I think that's money 6, votes 1. So suggesting a certain priority on the financial side. And so the Democrats have been greatly cross-pressured by this transformation of American politics. And that is part of the reason why they tend to have much more difficult holding together. And it tends to also be why they have been enabling in some of the key regulatory and policy changes we describe in the book. So, for example, every other year, Democrats rail against the so-called carried interest provision in the tax code that allows hedge fund managers to pay the low capital gains tax rate on their massive incomes, and which most observers, all observers basically, who don't have a vested interest in it, believe is a boondoggle. They rail against it, they come into office, and it magically survives. And it survived, I think, now 6 years after the 2006 election in which Democrats vowed to get rid of it. So enabling is usually not being on the forefront of pressing for policies that help those at the top, but it means doing very little in some cases to really push back against those policies and working behind the scenes to sort of modify or mollify opponents of those policies.
Jacob Hacker, there's a skepticism in your writing that I can only say it reminds me of myself. I wrote an article, and it was on the cover of The Atlantic magazine in 1977 about Jimmy Carter, and it showed him in a cartoon in a bathtub with Nelson Rockefeller. It was a sort of play on the Gold Dust Twins old soap ad. But my point, having covered Jimmy Carter, was that he was a kind of strange stealth Republican in the Democratic Party. He was a Southern governor, right-to-work state. It had no connection at all with the anti-war movement, which was all around him. His only connection with the civil rights movement was with Martin Luther King Sr., not Jr., Daddy King, a Nixon Republican. And he was a plant, I argued, by the Rockefeller interests in the Democratic Party. Lo and behold, in your book, it turns out he was the beginning of the conservative turning. There's another whole story to be told about Ronald Reagan, in my view, but I wonder if you want to tell it. Ronald Reagan is often blamed for George W. Bush. To my mind, Ronald Reagan was even then clearly a kind of a Main Street isolationist from Illinois, with a very little interest in the world, a huge feeling for this country. But that George W. Bush was the child of Wall Street, the oil companies, international power represented by the Rockefeller family, and that that's a whole different origin for the world we're living in now. I wonder if you want to sort of claim those ideas as your own, any of them.
Well, I want to talk about Carter, because I think this is a very important point of our book. You know, the central argument of our book, besides this point I just made, that the runaway inequality, particularly the pulling away of the top, is really tied up with changes in American politics and public policy, the central argument is that organization matters enormously in American politics, that we tend to focus on elections, we tend to focus on the spectacle of those huge races that occur every couple years, in the presidential case, every 4 years, and we tend to forget what happens after elections, about the work of lobbyists and interest groups and the slow effort to change who's in Congress through recruitment of candidates and certification of them by organizations, you know, saying who's right and who's wrong for our interest. And that's why the shift that occurs around 1978, that period you're talking about, is so surprising and so crucial. It is not an electoral shift, right? The Democrats have control of Congress. President Carter is in the White House. But between 1976 and 1980, the agenda of American politics fundamentally transformed. And we argued that it transformed because business, which had been on the defensive during the 1960s and 70s, particularly in the early 70s under Nixon on environmental and consumer issues, and Ralph Nader was basically was causing businessmen to flee from many policy debates, they turned around and fought back. They formed formidable organizations. They poured money into politics. And in 78, they won victory after victory after victory. It totally unexpected to many of those longtime Washington observers and longtime Washington politicians. The most dramatic victory is one that I think the consequences of which we live with today. I mean, the decline of American labor is a really important reason why inequality has grown. It's also an important reason why the politics of inequality has played out as it has. There is not a big organized force saying that these developments are a problem for the middle class, which is what labor in its heyday was doing, was focusing on sort of bread and butter and pocketbook issues. Organized labor was seeking in 1978 this massive rewriting of American labor law that would have helped it hold on to the gains it had received, it had earned in the past. And in 1978, it lost by the narrowest margins in a filibuster on the Senate floor, led by Orrin Hatch, among all people. And by the way, filibusters were very rare at this time. The only time that filibusters were generally used was on civil rights bills by Southern legislators. So this was a new development, and it was a powerful signal that business was going to push to get what it wanted. And everyone who had been involved in these debates said that they had never seen anything like it. Hmm. And the business groups, there's one of the business lobbyists we quote, say, you know, after they failed to, win the victory, we decided to invade, right? So then they passed a massive cut in the capital gains tax. Passed a number of more of conservative legislation under Carter before Reagan came into office. And so I think, again, we need to see that organization and interest groups and lobbying matter enormously alongside elections.
It's part of the line, too, though, that the problem is something deep in the laws of economics. And you keep arguing, no, it's about who gets what through political organization.
Exactly. And we know that there are forces pushing for greater inequality because most rich countries have experienced some increase in inequality. But for most, that increase has been pretty modest, and it's occurred mostly below the top of the income distribution. Mm. The kind of runaway inequality at the top that we see in the United States is quite distinctive to the U.S. and some other English-speaking nations, which really suggests it has something to do with politics and policy and the choices that are made. It's not some kind of inexorable law of global economics driven by technological change or the internet or some other kind of broad force. It has something to do with the way in which politicians have responded to these economic shifts. Mm. And that's the crucial point. If this is something that's shaped by politics and policy, it also means it can be changed by politics and policy. I mean, we really want this book to send a message that this is not inevitable. This is within the control of political leaders, and that we need to press political leaders to more effectively address the real economic insecurity and declining of the economic standing of those below the very top.
But first we have to wake up to our own interest, and then we have to find a language to organize around, and we've barely begun. This keeps coming up in lots of conversations I've had with Daron Acemoglu, for example, the economist of Why Nations Fail. He's talking about extractive politics.
Yep.
And Tom Friedman writes in the New York Times, he's talking about China. And Acemoglu says, no, we're talking about the United States. And the extractors are very clearly now the super rich who export their profits and take their capital gains, even like the Facebook multimillionaire, abroad. Or my favorite, my model, is Tony Judt in his last work, Ill Fares the Land, who says we've got to come to grips with, first of all, what we're losing in the social democracy. We've got to somehow wake up to the false god of money, 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 in our education, in our, you know, sending half of Princeton's class to Wall Street. And we've somehow got to do something about the public conversation, too. We've got to reconnect with people's experience, but also people's interest. Where are we in terms of the wake-up process?
Well, I think one thing we can say is that there's been a huge shift in the agenda, that Occupy Wall Street may have very little tangible effect on policies or organization. I mean, I think a real question about Occupy is to what extent are the sentiments that are being expressed there, the sort of idea that the 99% need to organize to press their interests, that they're really being translated into ongoing political action at a grassroots and national level that is directed towards some key goals, right, about changing the role of money in politics or changing specific policies. That's how political movements make a difference over the long term. But the fact is that for all the weaknesses of Occupy Wall Street and the excesses, it did bring the subject of inequality onto the political agenda in a way that we have not seen in my lifetime, at least. And it did it with a frame, the idea that this is really about the pulling away of the very rich, about the depredations of Wall Street, about the crony capitalism, the links between government and powerful private interests, the extractors you just talked about, that was the heart of the problem. That is all, I think, a very important part of having that conversation that's going to shift our politics over the long term. My own view, the view that I've expressed already, is that we tend to be too focused on elections, that as important as it is that the 2012 election turns out one way, that's not going to be how these shifts are reversed over the long term. If it's a 30-year war, it's going to have to be a long-term struggle to reshape our understandings, reshape our political organizations, reshape our grassroots political efforts, and ultimately reshape our policies. Mm. And this is deeply embedded in our policies. I mean, a key illustration of that is that while the talk has been all about the deficit in Washington, despite the fact that we just saw the unemployment rate tick up in the most recent jobs report, despite the fact that for most Americans that is the overwhelming priority, trying to get the economy moving again, the deficit is this huge topic, and yet the Republican standard bearer on the budget, Paul Ryan, has put forth a budget that calls for massive additional tax cuts for the very richest, paid for through unspecified closing of loopholes that nobody who's looked at it believes will or could actually happen. So what we're actually saying is the deficit matters to the extent as a cover for cutting programs that benefit the middle class and those who are less advantaged. And when it comes to dealing with the deficit, the fact that we have massively slashed taxes on the richest over a period in which there has been weak economic growth and weak jobs growth, and the median has seen its income stagnate. You know, as much of a refutation of the trickle-down theory as you could possibly hope for, that nonetheless, for many Republicans, are going to double down on this theory. So I just think that suggests there's a big fight coming, that there's no way to avoid, there's no way to think about this being a kind of, you know, grand, there's a grand bargain lurking beneath the current debates. I believe that we need a grand bargain, and I believe that there are policy elements to that grand bargain that actually you might be able to get both sides to agree to, but it's only going to happen after a massive fight in which the case has to be made. The case that I'm making has to be made that our government isn't working for the middle class, that the current theology that says that slashing taxes on the rich and cutting regulations will produce massive gains for the middle is false. That fight has to take place before any constructive action is possible.
It sounds to me like an asymmetrical fight you're talking about, partly because of that word theology. The theology of wealth, of private equity, is in the saddle, it seems to me.
Absolutely. I mean, we have very little in the way of a organized movement around these issues, and the language that has been used to talk about them is impoverished, I believe. So you, on one side, you have the proponents of letting Wall Street do whatever it wants and of cutting taxes on the wealthy at a time when we have record inequality, certainly in the post-Great Depression 1929 period. On one side, you have that clear and articulated argument that the market knows best, that you have to help the risk takers or the job creators.
Right.
And it's a mantra that's been repeated for 20 years and bought into by a lot of people on both sides of the political spectrum. But what's on the other side? I think right now, much of it is still pretty inchoate. It's a lot of the talk is about fairness. And I do think that these, you know, Dan Ariely's work suggests that there's some pretty basic notions of fairness that are completely at odds with our current economic realities. But I actually think that the much more basic argument, the one that Asimilagu and Robinson's work that you mentioned points to, is the idea that our economic and social health depends in the long term on having inclusive institutional developments that allow all people to share in the promise of America. And that is basically an economic argument in the end, right? Economic success rests on political inclusion, and our politics has become massively exclusionary. Everyone has the right to vote, though there's efforts to try to push people out of the voting booth in parts of the country. But not everyone has the ability to donate the kind of money that super PACs are putting into politics. Not everyone has the sway of lobbyists. Not everyone has the kind of cognitive, ideological weight that our elite right now has. And so there's got to be a very serious effort to create a counterweight. And that's going to be an argument based on, you know, what's the best way to have prosperity that's shared broadly. And also it has to be based on organization, right? We have to have people brought together in the same way that they were brought together in the civil rights movement and in the labor movement. And that's a big challenge in our era. But I think that's the only way we'll have sustained efforts to push back.
Why does it feel so hard?
Well, I do think that one of the most fundamental reasons it's difficult is that most Americans are radically alienated from their government, right? There's just a distrust, a sense of despair. The numbers are, you know, the poll numbers are just stunning, that we have so little faith in our collective political institutions right now.
Well,
talk about asymmetries, right? That is a much greater threat to the agenda of those who want to use government in an active way to deal with inequities in society than it is to those who believe the government's role should mostly be basically enabling those who are winning in the economic free-for-all that or economic world to hold on to and expand their winnings. So that's, I think, the fundamental problem. And if that's the fundamental problem, then obviously all ideas for reform have to run through this question of how do you rebuild trust. So I would say two things seem like they should be the basis for a serious campaign to organize citizens in an era in which we know from Robert Putnam's work and Theda Skocpol's work that social capital and civic organization has massively declined. One has to be the simple proposition that democracy isn't for sale. And after Citizens United, I think the only viable option for changing it is a constitutional amendment. And I don't have very high hopes for the ability to do that, but I think it would be a powerful organizing rally. And I think that it has much more clarity than a lot of the sort of reformist ideas that are out there today. The second area where I would say that there has to be much, much greater organization and clarity has to do with the massive imbalances in our tax code and more generally what our government does. And to me, that's an area that has obviously been very much in the debate. But I think that there's a sense in which for most people, you know, you get overwhelming public support for the idea that we should have higher taxes on the very well off. But that support seems to be very tepid and not intense enough to counter the very intense opposition to that position. We're going to have an opportunity to have a very clear debate about taxes in the next few months as the Bush tax cuts expire. And there is a move underway, I think, to try to preempt that expiration with the concern that if there is a massive lapse in the law and the taxes are scheduled to go into effect across the board, that is, middle class tax cuts will expire alongside upper income tax cuts, that will somehow either spook the markets, hurt the economy, or be a political disaster. My own view is that the only way in which you're going to these issues on the agenda in a way that will lead to reversing the top income tax cuts, the Bush tax cuts, is going to be to have to cross that threshold. Now, that's just one fight. The longer term, you need to have a kind of clear goal that is tied up with, but not exclusive to or synonymous with, tax reform. So for my view that we should have restore some progressivity at the top of the tax code, that we should tax those who have done so well over the last generation, has to be tied to some goal, right? And the goal for my mind is that we need to rebuild the American economy, and starting with rebuilding our crumbling infrastructure. It has to be simple. It has to be direct. Use government to put people to work. Use government to rebuild the kind of underlying infrastructure, the underlying good old-fashioned bridges and roads and transportation network. I mean, this, I think, is really important to understand, is that the discussion of American politics has until very recently been dominated by a very narrow spectrum of concerns. And so questions of political reform and economic reform have been pushed to the side as being either unrealistic or unnecessary because of our huge economic success. And what we're finding, the more we look at it, the more we sort of scrape beneath the surface and look at the numbers, is that the United States has really lost its way economically because we've seen growth, but much of that growth has gone to a very narrow slice of Americans. We've seen growing technological sophistication in our economy and in healthcare, but we've also seen Americans grow increasingly insecure, less likely to have insurance, bearing more of the costs on their own. You know, we've seen life expectancy increase, though less here than in many other rich countries, but we don't have a retirement security system that works to ensure that people have a basic protections against poverty or hardship in old age. We have essentially, I think, been running on the fumes of many of the investments we made in the immediate post-war years through the 1970s, and we're now just beginning to realize how far behind we are. And that's, unfortunately, a difficult message to put out there, but it's true. And the story of American democracy, of American history, is of recognizing these challenges, not having blind optimism, and responding to them. Usually it takes strife and struggle and movements, but it happens. In the Progressive Era it happened, in the New Deal it happened, during the Civil Rights Era it happened. And, you know, I think it's fair to say there was a conservative mobilization, too, that had its own specific concerns that brought new issues to the fore. Today, we need to see a real movement to reclaim some of the basic elements of the American dream that we hold dear that have been affirmed and reaffirmed through these struggles.
Can I say, part of where we're at is new, though, and the response to the sense of a sort of slipping supremacy is also naturally one of panic, denial, retreat. How do we get traction with reality in a constructive way at this point?
Well, I think that the challenge we face is not China. The challenge we face is not the Eurozone economies. Right now, they're looking like they have plenty of problems on their own hands. I mean, I think it's really quite clearly internal to the American economy in this sense that we have very high rates of productivity as an economy. We have enormous wealth, and it should be within our power to address a large number of the festering problems that set us apart from other rich democracies. Our high rates of poverty, especially among children, our runaway inequality, which is now at levels that we don't see in any developed country, we see in developing countries, our failure to deliver good health outcomes, despite the fact that we spend so much on healthcare, our social mobility. This is something that I think I should have mentioned earlier, right? We are not more mobile than other countries. Our intergenerational mobility, you know, the ability of people to rise up to a higher station, we're finding is pretty much the lowest in the advanced industrial world. We can address these problems. And more important, in addressing these problems, we'll actually make our economy stronger, more competitive, more prosperous. And it won't be that ephemeral prosperity of the financial crisis and the bubble. And it won't be that prosperity that only is received by a tiny slice of people at the top. It will be shared prosperity that is associated with the kinds of investments, the kind of long-term thinking about our economic strategy that...
I just have to ask you, and forgive me for interrupting, but who's going to cut through, though, and say, we can't rebuild this economy with young people carrying $1 trillion worth of student debt, for example, for starters?
Well, I think it's hard to identify the savior who will come along. In fact, I think part of the mistake is that we who are concerned about these trends tend to invest one single individual or leader with this, you know, halo, with this idea that that he or she is going to be our redeemer. And the fact is that if you look historically, while there have been charismatic leaders, they've been backed up by progressive movements, and that's really where it's going to have to come from. But I think you actually are hitting one of the crucial issues in this, is that as you look at this job market and as you think about the ways in which our fiscal challenges are currently being discussed and could be addressed based on that discussion, it is young Americans who have the most at stake and who are losing the most in this moment and in these discussions. So to my mind, that is going to be one of the crucial areas. I think another crucial sources of discussion, and, you know, I see it in my own students as a professor.
Yeah,
you know,
tell us.
Yeah, no, I mean, look, Yale is an enormously privileged institution. The students here have very bright prospects compared with many young Americans today. But there's a very deep sense of unease among them, a sense that they need to get out there and actually not just find a job, but try to make sure in whatever ways they can that that they're helping contribute to society and to helping those who they know or who they identify with who are young like them figure out how to navigate this terrible economy. And so I don't want to invest too much into this generational image. But I think it's important to understand that the young of today feel as if the system isn't working in a way that is much stronger than kids coming up when I was young in the 70s or when, you know, or those who were growing up in the 80s and 90s. And I think that is a generational shift that may have some may play out in our politics in a powerful way. I still will come back to the idea that I just think you have to have a movement. It has to be focused around cleaning up American politics and pursuing a few big goals to renew our economy, to make the middle class strong again. And it's going to have strong leaders, but you can't just have strong leaders, because we know that just in saying this guy is going to save us usually leaves us disappointed.
Dan Ariely says something like that, that the kids who lived through this collapse of 07, 08, 09 to this day will have an entirely different consciousness, and they will lead us in a different direction. He also says it might take 40 years in the desert to let the old dinosaurs go.
40 years is a long time to wait. As I said, it was a 30-year war for us to get here. And I think it will take more than a decade to really see a change in our politics. And a lot of damage can be done in a decade. So this is no cause for complacency. It's got to begin now. The pressure has to begin now. The organization has to begin now. And, you know, the stirrings that we saw in the Middle East, the stirrings we saw in the Midwest around the stripping of collective bargaining, the stirrings we saw in New York and across the country around Occupy Wall Street, these were movements that shared in common one salient feature. It was lots of pretty ordinary people saying that they felt that things were going the wrong way. And it should be said, the Tea Party, for the most part, represents a similar kind of sentiment. So that's going to have to be part of the addressing it. I think another important thing to remember, and this is what I said before, is that these challenges are not unprecedented. And I think in particular, the progressive era, it's the area that I keep going back to in thinking about our present challenges. In part because so much of what we think of as the New Deal, the 1930s, was really born in the progressive era by the organizing and thinking that took place then. So the progressive era was a period in which you had corporations controlling government, a very weak national government, state governments overrun with corporate lobbying and fearful of losing business. You had great injustices in the workplace. You had huge inequality, the kind of inequality that we hadn't seen until just the last few years in the United States again. And yet, while there was, I would say, only mixed success, there was a real movement, and it was stretching down to local communities. It involved very broad-based civic action. It was really a great flowering of organizational action, labor movement, progressive organizations fighting for better rules governing the workplace, for social insurance programs like health insurance. This provided the backdrop for, and much of the policy inspiration for, President Roosevelt's New Deal. So I think that's what we need today. We need another progressive renewal. And I think there's more sign now than there has been for a long time that progressive renewal is, if not in the works, it's widely recognized to be needed.
Jacob Hacker, I take a lot of your work to be a kind of decoding and unmasking of the shell games that got us here. I'd love to come back through this 2012 campaign and let you decode it as it goes. Thank you so much for your work. Thank you for this conversation.
Well, thanks for having me, Chris. It's a real pleasure.
Jacob Hacker is the co-author of Winner Take All Politics, How Washington Made the Rich Richer and Turned Its Back on the Middle Class. Mary McGrath produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over until you add your two bits in a comment on our website, radioopensource.org. Our next round of conversations is all about inequality in America, how it happened, where it's going, who's getting hurt. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for joining the conversation.